90% of all scientists that have ever been alive are alive today. That's a lot of information. But don't panic. It's not an exact science.
Hey, Shannon, how are you?
Doing pretty well. It's been very quiet here this week. Definitely not like your week.
Yeah, I mean, the internet melted on Tuesday.
I still watch cat videos. I don't understand what you're talking about. I meant
so
I work.
Amazon, right? Amazon Web Services, specifically the S3 storage, had a prolonged multi-hour outage on Tuesday, which meant that a lot of internet services that depend on it didn't work. So you notice, like, Slack wasn't great. A lot of the continuous integration tools that we use at work, things like avatars on a lot of websites didn't load. Nest was down because of it. There was a lot of stuff that was down and a lot of people running around. I'm sure at Amazon, you know, saying, the servers are on fire. And some of the other companies, one company that depended on S3, tweeted a picture of somebody curled up in the floor and said, we're just staying like this until it's over.
Oh, that's beautiful. And of course, on top of this, I mean, there was a pretty big severe weather outbreak too, right?
Yeah, so there were some tornadoes in Illinois, and at the same time, the KLOT radar, the WSR-88D, went down as well.
Oh, unbelievable.
Yes, so there was a lot of crazy atmospheric things going on with equipment malfunctions, and it was a interesting day.
Oh, well, everyone survived.
Yes. Yeah, no, it all turned out pretty good. Things are catching up as we're recording this.
Excellent.
And hopefully the rest of the week will be quiet. I know it's supposed to get nice and warm here again, 70s this weekend, so yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
Yes, exactly. Amen.
Are you going back into the field?
No, thank goodness. It's my own field work from here on in.
Oh, yeah. That is pretty lucky.
Yes, yes, exactly. I'm sure the weekend that we're going out, it'll be like 30 degrees, but well, let's hope for the best.
Right. But, well, we're going to have a special guest join us today, right?
Yeah, I'm very excited about this, mostly because I don't know a lot about it. And, you know, I like talking about geophysics.
Right. And it's one that our listeners are very excited about as well. I put a call out for questions about this since it was a listener requested episode, and we got a lot. So strap in. It might be a little bit of a long show, but we're really happy to have Robert Busby join us from the Transportable Array. Hi, how are you?
I'm very fine. Thank you.
Great. Well, like I said, this has been one of those shows that we've had lots of listeners request, and previous guest of the show, Dr. Charles Amon, recommended that we get you on to talk about it. And we have lots of listener questions. But before we dive into the Transportable Array and Earthscope, would you mind telling us a little bit about your background?
Sure. I was an undergraduate student at University of Wyoming. I grew up in Wyoming. And at that time, I was a student in the astronomy department and spent some time on the mountaintop telescope that they have there. I graduated and then went to University of Colorado in Boulder, where I joined the lab with the National Bureau of Standards. My advisor, Judah Levine, did work on time and frequency standards, and he had an interest in geophysics and applying physics to precise measurement of geophysical problems, laser distance measurement, and there was a project going to measure the tilt of Yellowstone Park, so I thought this was an interesting problem, both from a instrumentation and physics point of view, but also it was near where I grew up, so it had a lot of interest for me. So that's how I got into it.
So I don't see how you can grow up in Wyoming and not, especially near Yellowstone, and not sort of pay attention to the geology of the area, right?
Yeah, that's right. There was lots of hiking and camping and mountain climbing and so on. So it was in your face.
Well, so, you know, you said you spent some time with telescopes, which sounds like that'd be a lot of fun, and then worked with standards. So how did you end up working with the transportable array or the US array?
Well, from graduate school, at that time at the University of Colorado, it was the very beginning of GPS-based measurements. In fact, we received one of the very first GPS instruments in our lab and set it up and learned that you could get the location of where the antenna was placed just on a screen. It was a remarkable kind of device. And so that attracted people like Roger Billum from, at that time, he was at Columbia University and was a geodesist and geophysicist. And he came to visit the lab and explained a lot of the other measurements that were going on in the world and so on. At that time, I was getting a little disappointed with the physics curriculum at University of Colorado because it was kind of focused on quantum mechanics and a lot of math drudgery, I thought. And Roger explained a lot of these sort of adventure projects that were out there. And so he recommended that I could actually just get a job in instrumentation and field engineering and so on. So I left after getting my master's and moved to Columbia University, where they were doing a lot of field work in seismology and other places. At that time, there was a project related to strong ground motion and building code standards in the East Coast, led by Klaus Jacob, the National Center for Earthquake Engineering Research. So they were starting a measurement program, and I was hired as one of the engineers to deploy instruments and so on. And after that, a couple of years, two or three years later, this IRIS program, the Incorporated Research Institutions for Seismology, started a portable instrument program where they would have a pool of instruments and then loan them out to somebody who had an interesting idea. But you needed a supporting engineer to go along with these deployments. So I started doing that. And this was in 91 to 94 or so. So we ended up going around and seeing many places in the world, many types of environments, while trying to keep the instruments working and pursue what science objective the individual PI may have had for that. So it began a long kind of history of supporting instrumentation in the field. I left that in 94, sort of continued as a consultant. I became a consulting engineer for my own company and worked both for IRIS as a consulting engineer, as well as other people like equipment manufacturers doing national networks, and for Caltech as they were just beginning the Southern California seismic network. So began to sort of design and develop network-based instrumentation systems and earthquake monitoring from not just one station but multiple stations. And so that's how I got into that. And then the idea of the transportable array was getting more traction. It was sort of an expansion of the earlier work that I had done, where individual PIs would put out 20 to 50 instruments or something like that. And the transportable array was kind of born on the idea that, why don't we just do the whole continent in one shot, and then we don't have to do piecemeal type of things. And that's a fairly audacious idea.
Right.
So I guess for our listeners who don't know, even though obviously a lot of them do and are very interested in this, could you just sort of, what is the transportable array then?
So the transportable arrays is the idea is to put out a grid of seismometers, so one every 40 miles or 70 kilometers, and then be able to use passive sources, earthquakes, to image the structure underneath the continent from sort of shallow crustal depths of maybe 5 kilometers down to the core mantle boundary. And so the bigger the array, the more of an image that you can create in one shot. And unfortunately, as they began to scope out the size of the project and so on, you realize you couldn't actually cover the whole continent with enough instruments. That's almost 2,000. So they had to pare that back, and they settled on an idea where they would just have about 400 or so at a time, and these 400 would kind of march across the country in a almost like a fax machine in the old days, or a scanning device nowadays would do an imaging program. But you would have a big patch of the country covered, and then you'd slowly move across. So that became much more of a logistical problem, and a lot of difficulty in setting up the instruments for just a short period of time and then taking them down again. So it was a kind of funny government job of digging holes and filling them in again. So.
How long do they stay in place then, when you guys first started?
So we, at the beginning, it was a little bit slow, but it ended up, the stations would operate for 2 years at a time. So you'd put them in, and then 2 years later come back, pick them up, and then you'd move them, leapfrogging across all the rest of the stations further to the east, and place them again for 2 years. And each station hopped about four times across the continent. So we started in California and did some work there, moved up to Oregon and Washington, and then got the full array developed from the Pacific coast out to about Yellowstone. That's 400 instruments from the northern border to the southern border. And then we would move them about 20 per month or 200 per year, eastward, north and south, south in the summer, in the wintertime, and north in the summertime, and move the way across. And there's a little video of this I can give you a link to, so you can kind of imagine how that actually worked.
Awesome.
Yeah, we'll put it in the notes for sure. And it sounds like, you know, you said it's this kind of funny job of digging holes and filling them back in again, but I cannot even really imagine the logistics involved with managing hundreds of instruments at once, leapfrogging them across, making sure that they're actually working. And I'm assuming there may have been some maintenance visits. So how did you end up orchestrating all of that?
So my job is the manager of the project, and that involved both acquiring sort of the instrumentation and making sure the station design worked. But we assembled a staff of about 30 people, and approximately half of those people were the field group. That is, they were full-time out in the field working every day. It wasn't just a two-week summer stint or something like that. They were every day in the job. And so this involved about four or five people that did nothing but dig the holes, do the construction work where they would have a backhoe. We actually owned a backhoe and would haul it around and dig holes and stick a tank in the ground and set up some of the cabling and posts. And then we had two teams of two engineers apiece, so four altogether, that would work independently to install the scientific instruments, the seismometer, which would sit in the bottom of the hole, and the recording electronics, which are mounted higher up, and then solar panels for providing power. And so these four individuals would move along about a month behind the construction group and set up the instruments. And we had another team of two to three people who would do repairs and maintenance and fix problems that would arise at any time, maybe even a month after install, or could be up to 18 months later. We had finally one additional team, which was the removal team, and they would come and collect the instruments, pack them into utility trailers, and then dig up the hole or fill in the hole and move on to the next one. So they would pack up all these trailers, and then at the end of each month, they would drive the trailer about 400 miles to the east, and then leave the trailer for the install guys, who would pick up that trailer for that month and go on. So it was a roving, rolling kind of experiment, and it was quite an effort to actually set that whole chain of events in motion. And we would suffer occasionally when, you know, weather would slow up the beginning of the train, and so just like a traffic accident or whatever, the rest of the team would kind of get backed up behind them, and people would move ahead to try to help the construction guys. So it was a real, you know, team effort with lots of people, and the same sort of process kind of occurred with the data flow, because in the early days when this project was envisioned, it was, believe it or not, before the age of cell phones, and there were cellular telephones, but they were not used for data. In fact, we had to sort of sneak our data connections onto the cellular networks while we were working in California, Oregon, Washington. The companies did not want us to make a permanent or a continuous connection. They wanted you to make a call and hang up.
Yep.
And so we had to design the instruments to sort of do this in the background so that they wouldn't notice that we were sending lots of data across the network. And eventually they came around to, you know, data is a normal thing that you would actually want to have a contract with the company to continuously. And so that actually turned into a huge advantage to us, because we could more easily set up our data telemetry through cellular connections, rather than the way the project was originally envisioned, required a satellite dish at every site, which takes lots of power and lots of effort to set up and so on. So we got really lucky riding the wave of cellular data connections.
Well, as soon as I figured out they could charge you for it, I guess that was okay.
Well, they made the mistake of giving us an unlimited data plan, and that
beautiful.
We send about 4 gigabytes a day, so it's
grandfather.
Is that per instrument or for the network?
It's for the network. So each instrument sends about. It's gone up. We started, it was about 25 megabytes a day, and now the stations, because of additional channels and higher sampling rates, some strong motion instruments are at some of the stations, so we can send up to 80 to 100 megabytes a day per station, or kind of pushing the 5 to 10 gigabyte limit per month of each station. And overall, you know, in the lower 48, we've recorded about 25 terabytes of data, I would say.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
That's
a lot. And so I'm an instrumentation person myself. I really like instruments and trying to, you know, ruggedize them and take them to the field. I imagine there's a lot of thought that went into the packaging of these stations, right? Because you had to be able to deploy them, and they had to be rugged enough to stay out for 2 years, but then easily broken down, packed up, and moved on, and reusable. So what was that process like?
So most of the ruggedization that we were focused on was how the instruments could survive while being deployed with a design goal of having almost no service. In fact, we were pretty successful in that. Almost about 60% of the stations once deployed were never visited until 2 years later they were picked up and moved on to the next thing, and if most of the service visits were for something quite minor. But that goes into the design of a sort of the enclosure. So we while I was at Caltech in Southern California, they had been experimenting with this tank-like design that allows you to put all the instruments underground. This protects them from changing temperatures, which improves the data noise somewhat, especially for the seismometer, but also allows you to adapt the instruments to new changes or different interconnection arrangements, all within the same overall environmental enclosure. So the tank design we developed allowed us to sort of adapt to more and more different kinds of instruments, all within the same basic enclosure. So we depended on this tank to sort of protect us from all sorts of things, floods, fires. There has been forest fires go right across the instruments. One of the instruments never survived the hurricane flooding in Louisiana. That was one of the few we ever lost and didn't ever recover. But for the most part, it was the tank design that helped that. And then we would put the seismometers in the bottom of the tank, enclosed in sand, with the bilge pumps as a sort of backup. In case the tank did leak, it would pump the water out and the station would sort of survive. So we didn't depend on moving those tanks necessarily between each site. For one, many of the landowners preferred that we just leave the tanks in the ground after we were done. Most of them were interested in the science project continuing, but if not, they didn't see any problem with having this tank wherever it was. So that was one reason we didn't have to do that. And the rest of the stuff, the seismometer and the electronics instruments, could be packed up in fairly small bundles, about maybe 8 cubic feet or so, and therefore we could put 6 or 8 stations inside of a single utility truck that the crew would drive around in, and so they could do lots of stations without ever going back to a warehouse or a depot. We'd use just the storage locations in many places with the roll-up door and so on, but you'd end up putting about $1 million worth of equipment inside of the storage locker.
Oh, man.
So yeah, how much was each station then roughly? I mean, I know you had a broadband, maybe some strong motion. Some of them had environment packages, infrasound.
Yep.
And then telemetry. So you add all that up, and that's getting pretty expensive.
Yeah, it's about $42,000 in the hole. And that was one of the things the landowners couldn't quite believe, that, well, you're just going to put this here, and you don't need any kind of protection, or what happens if it gets stolen or something. And none ever got stolen in the lower 48. In fact, very few were even disturbed, except we've had some solar panels broken when we had some in some schoolyards, and nothing really ever got damaged by a sort of malicious behavior. Farmers would run into the tanks or something if they forgot that the whole thing was there, and would be plowing their fields, and occasionally would damage the tank that way. But for the most part, people were very nice to host the stations.
So when we had the Prague earthquake here in Oklahoma, I remember that was one of my graduate student duties, because although I'm a geologist, I dabble in geophysics, and they said, go out ahead of us and ask people if we can dig these things and leave them in their yards. And so that was, I mean, it was hard at first, but how did you guys do that? Explain to the landowner, what you're doing, and let them leave this $40,000 in their yards.
So actually we relied on students. So we had a strategy whereby we would try to hire students from local universities. And I think this was, it was sort of a lucky approach. It wasn't really well thought out at the very beginning, but it sort of worked, in the sense that we wanted to give students the opportunity to participate, for one, and then to give them something meaningful to do towards the project. But it required a lot of preparation on our part. We would spend a week or so at a location, bring in probably 10 teams of pairs of students with a professor from a local university, and we would teach a week-long course on, so here's the information, here's about the project, here's approaches that you can use in discussing the science with the landowners, and so on, and here's the type of report that you need to make related to the place that you have finally picked. So we had to teach them about the criteria that we wanted to have, and how you can document that, how you check that the cell modem might work, check the ground conditions. All of these things were in a sort of almost workbook-like materials that they would go through. But the biggest thing, and we would explain this to students, and they were very skeptical at the beginning of this, to tell them that this is actually a terrific educational experience for you because, number one, you will be, for the first time, acting like or being a professional scientist, and therefore you have to explain to the public what this science project is, and you have to kind of advocate for a certain outcome, and you'd like to put this station here if they will let you, and you have to be able to engage with them in a dialogue about, well, what are they interested in, why do they think this might be interesting, why do you think it would be a good idea, and so on. And so they would have to kind of wear the mantle of a scientist for the first time, and I think many of them came away with that experience as being a profound sort of change, that it sort of set them on a course. And we also had, you know, deliverables and things like that, so that was the other thing we would teach the student. This is a job. We're paying you to go out and find 20 sites, each student, and we're giving you 10 weeks to do it, and if you finish early, great, no problem, have fun the rest of the summer. If you wait and delay it until the very end of the year, then we'll keep haranguing you. So it was it was very much like a job, but a real science job.
Man, I didn't get paid to do that.
So listener Joe had asked that, and also, you know, was there a lot of convincing to do, or did you find that people were pretty receptive to you burying this big barrel with $40,000 worth of equipment in their backyard?
Yeah, it's about the size of a refrigerator when we did bring a real backhoe and dig a hole. So it was, you know, something that the landowners needed to consider, and we wanted to make sure that the students actually conveyed what the scale of the thing. So after the students were done and completed their report, we would then send around a verification team. So some people who have done this kind of work, and they would interview the landowner, make sure that the site was good and that they were interested really in the project and so on. But for the most part, once the landowners learned that it was a university-based research project, that students were involved, and in fact students from a nearby university, not from, you know, 10 states away or something like that, but they were typically, you know, within driving range of that place. So that was one of the motivations for hiring local students. But then also they became interested in the science. So after that, many of these rural properties weren't all that concerned about the disturbance. It was just a fairly, you know, minor impact on their land, but we actually have a website that shows the recordings of that particular station with the earthquakes that are, they're annotated on that particular website, and you can see what's happening on their property. And many of the landowners kind of adopted that website as their station and their data, and they were proud of it. They would show their neighbors and friends and family, you know, here's what's happening on my land. And that's right. Why they became interested. You know, they have a station and nobody else in the neighborhood does.
That's excellent.
Yeah, and there were a few legacy stations that were left behind as well. And actually one of them is maybe 2 or 3 miles north of the farm I grew up on. And, you know, I know that it's always neat to go back and look there and look at the recording of different earthquakes there just because, well, it's somewhere, you know, it's fun.
That's right. Yeah, there were quite a few sites that ended up being left. Overall, about 200 out of the 1,800 sites that were occupied in the lower 48, about 200 remain operating. Some of those were individual states. Oklahoma, Colorado, Ohio had interest in continuing monitoring, primarily for fracking activities and things like that. Other states, Arkansas had interest in seismicity due to New Madrid, and Pennsylvania had interest because of the fracking, and the state geologists wanted to establish a better permanent network there and so on. So various organizations wanted to keep the capability going and found ways to do that. And then a sort of bigger effort was spawned right after the Mineral Virginia earthquake to keep a big swath of stations. We called it one in four, or one out of every four TA stations could be left and provide a big backbone for the sort of rare events that happen in the East. They're not very well recorded because the seismometers are usually in pockets right around the seismicity, but invariably the interesting earthquakes are outside those regions. They pop up in unusual places. Right. And so, they always report that the Deming earthquake was on an unknown fault. So.
I mean, that's a well-known fact about instrumentation, is if you want to ensure that the phenomena that you're studying never occurs in your study area, put instruments out.
Right. We've actually had almost the opposite luck, really. We arrived in Oklahoma just as the upswing in seismicity occurred, associated with oil and gas activity and so on. And we happened to be in kind of the right place for the Mineral Virginia earthquake and a number of other kind of unusual events. We happened to be right there, and that's continued even last year in Alaska. We had just put stations out, and there was the January of 2016 was a 7.1 earthquake pretty much surrounding our instruments were surrounding that event. So we've been lucky.
Yeah, that's some serendipity for sure.
So, you know, we've talked about the lower 48 quite a bit, and we had several questions from listeners, Michael and Elisa, about the deployment that's now going on in Alaska. And that's probably a lot different than doing field work in the lower 48.
Yeah, the logistics and the planning are considerably different. In this case, we can cover all of Alaska and portions of Yukon and British Columbia. We kind of went colored outside the lines a little bit to go into Canada. But, we can do all that with about 200 or so instruments. It totals about 270 with some existing stations that are there, but we put in 200 more. So we can do that in one kind of deployment. We don't have to do a rolling thing. But the deal is there's no roads or anything in like that in Alaska. You can go around the coast by boat, but that's pretty slow. So much of the remote field work had the same sort of strategy. We wanted to put a station every 50 miles in this case and cover the entire region. And in there, there's a very active subduction zone with a slab sliding underneath Denali, and it's a dramatic place to work, both from an earthquake perspective, but the geology and the geography are, you know, spectacular. But the logistics are quite difficult, and there you have to get around to many of the stations by helicopter. And so we had to redesign our station such that it was much lighter and did not involve burying a big tank in the ground. We couldn't come up with a way to make an excavation that would be lightweight and transportable. So we migrated to a different design where we would just insert the seismometer in a shallow borehole that was only 6 inches in diameter and about 3 meters deep. But then we would put all the equipment in an above ground hut, and that hut would be sort of the inverse of a tank, in which case the hut would have the solar panels mounted directly on it and everything put inside. So the seismometer was the only thing underground. But that required kind of first experimenting with, well, can you put a seismometer in frozen ground and not have it become frost-jacked or disturbed by frozen ground tilting around? Does it even make sense to do that? So we did some early trials, and sure enough, it actually is turns out the frozen ground is hard as a rock, so it performs very well. And then we had once deciding that, okay, the seismometer works well, how do we actually make this hole? And we experimented with, you know, you can just hire a driller in Alaska easily enough along the roads, but we wanted to be able to go to places where we could pick an outcrop and go just deep enough to where the seismometer would be stable, but not spend a lot of extra weight and money on drilling really deep. So we had to come up with a lightweight, specialized kind of drill that would make the hole that we needed, sleeve the hole with a steel casing, and make a good place for the seismometer, but still be light enough and easily maneuverable that a helicopter could pick it up and fly it 90 miles easily and drop it down and then drill another hole and continue on. So the whole project's logistics then turned into a kind of migration from a single kind of camp or village, small village, and you would go out in a spoke pattern to four or five, maybe six stations, and then hop to the next sort of hub and do a four or five little spoke-like thing. And then these campaigns would last for 2 or 3 weeks, and then usually we'd just swap in another team, and they would carry on. A different driller would operate the drill, but the helicopter crews would swap out their staff as well, and the progress would continue. So we worked all summer, last summer, doing that, about put in about 70 stations. And right now, the network there is, at the moment, a total of about 190 stations. We'll add another 70 new stations next year in quite remote regions. Now we've done most of the areas that are close by the airports and things like that, or in the northern part off of the Dalton Highway or the Pipeline Highway. So what's left is the ones in very remote regions in northern Canada at the Beaufort Sea, and then western Alaska. So it's taken a while to kind of get the exact logistic plan and the exact kind of equipment optimized, but the results are terrific, actually. The seismometers work better there than they did in the lower 48. So
wow. So one of our listeners, listener Matt, had asked, when are you doing Canada? So I guess you've kind of already done a little bit of it.
We have about 50 stations, yeah, in the Yukon and in British Columbia. But as it turns out, at the moment, the Canadians are quite excited by this program, which has hopped, you know, went past them in Oregon and Washington, and now it's up in Alaska, and they're proposing to use the same capability, basically invite us in and install an array in British Columbia that would fit in between Yukon and Oregon and Washington and fill in the imaging all along the subduction zone there, which is quite enigmatic, where it goes from a subducting slab in Oregon and Washington to a different slab in Alaska going the other direction.
Right.
And it's mostly strike slip along the Queen Charlotte Islands and Haida Gwaii. And so that transition is a little bit difficult to imagine. And the imaging that this array can do would sort of clear up a lot of hypotheses about how that transition works. And so the Canadians are trying to propose such a thing. It will probably take them 3 or 4 years to get it ready, and by that time we'll be finishing up in Alaska. We plan to finish in Alaska in 2019 or 2020, and then so we could be ready to move into British Columbia. But I don't think we'll go all the way across Canada. That's
well, and you know, in all these far northern stations, you said the permafrost was great because it was hard as rock, but did you see any, this is listener Eliza, did you see any effects from, you know, the steady departure from normal mean annual temperatures or erosion, wildfires, anything like that. I mean, there's several things up there that could make the field situation dynamically changing.
Yeah, so one of the biggest changes, there's two big things. The permafrost is thawing, and actually we work with the University of Alaska Fairbanks and NASA on a project to insert thermistor strings into the ground at each of our sites. And the National Weather Service has worked with us to provide meteorological instruments where we measure the wind speed, wind direction, and we add this to our telemetry so that they can improve the weather forecasting. But the permafrost melts in a kind of funny way. There's an active layer in which the topmost portion of the permafrost becomes not frozen, and then that might extend down to a depth of a meter or so, and as it warms it gets a little bit deeper and deeper, so that starts to impact where our instruments are buried. We try to get them 2.5 meters deep, so that can introduce problems. We don't see that just yet. It's a very slow change. Other more dramatic changes are as the tundra changes, some of the vegetative species, it becomes more woody and more prone to brush fires. So they've actually had lightning, which has been very rare in the north, has started to be a problem that can ignite tundra fires. And this is a bit of a threat to our stations. We've had one station in Alaska already burn up in a forest fire, and so that's another factor in these areas. But direct, you know, climate change, we don't really see that. We do. There's an animation I can show you or give you a link to, which shows you the difference in seismic noise in the very northernmost stations, ones in Barrow and Sax Harbor on Banks Island and Palatuk, and there's several villages that are right along the shore. And as we put more stations in, you can see a dramatic shift in the microseism noise as the ocean waves change from being damped by the sea ice to when the sea ice melts, and then you get a lot of shore break, and the seismic noise at 1 hertz comes right up. And this happens in a day or 2 days as the mechanical strength of the ice melts and there becomes waves. So you can actually track the arrival and freeze up of the nearshore ice. And that's quite a interesting research topic for many of the sea ice researchers and people, especially for the indigenous population, to know when the ice is safe to travel on or whether it's melting out earlier and so on. And we can track this year by year as it changes. So you just map it against satellite views, but they get blocked by clouds and stuff like that. We don't have that problem.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. Like, some of these people who are so used to working with satellites, and to be like, no, we have this data from these seismometers. That seems really awesome.
Yeah, I'll give you a link to the slide.
Yeah, and you know, you were talking about doing some studies with these noise and microseisms and that kind of thing. I seem to remember a while back an animation or a little article about actually locating large storms with noise from the network too, right?
That's right. Yeah, when big hurricanes or pressure cells move along in the ocean, they generate large swells, and these you can actually do a back projection or a beam forming from the array and identify the source of the noise. So that's this whole beamforming aspect was imagined with the transportable array, but there was never a dense enough network to actually try that. And that's been one of the more, I would say, significant results or capabilities of the array is this, and it's used not just with our array now, but several large arrays like the HiNet in Japan, but the transportable array and even China array, although there's some difficulty in getting data access from them, but that people put these together and are able to kind of look back at the source of very large earthquakes and then map out the way the earthquake ruptures, both in space, in two dimensions, and also in time. So you see patches break and then another patch break further north. And this is advancing quite a bit of theories in how very large megathrust events work on different kinds of subduction zones. And that's, I think, one of the more important contributions to public safety is to understand how these really threatening earthquakes work. How often do they occur? What kinds of ruptures are they? Are there any telltale signs ahead of that? It's not really earthquake prediction, but it's if you can recognize that the subduction zone is becoming restless, then you have a better chance of being prepared.
Right, and so I guess that really leads into listener Michael asked what the top three significant discoveries you thought were from the transportable array. And I know you had mentioned back projection, and that seems like a pretty significant result.
It is, yeah. It's a complicated process to develop the view or to do the mathematics of kind of solving for where the waves come from. But the result is easily interpreted by non-specialists. So you can see this map. Even laymen can see a map of what's rupturing and how this jumps around and how it may lead to better understanding of earthquakes. So I think that's a significant one. The question always in these kind of earthquakes is how come a magnitude 7.5 becomes an 8 or becomes a 9? Why, and if it can become a 9, why doesn't it just keep going? What stops a big earthquake? So these views of how the earthquake actually ruptures are important clues to the understanding. So that's one big one. I think the one that we expected to get is a tomography, which is a standard oil company technique, or P-wave tomography, where you just time the arrivals of the first waves that impact on the stations, and you can do an inversion process and determine the structure. But folks in San Diego, Burdick and et al. Have done a lot of these big maps as the TA has marched across the entire continent, and producing that map was the primary goal of the transportable array. The project is, you know, $100 million effort, but that was the thing that drove it, and they've been successful in doing that, and mapping structure, depth to MOHO. These constrain lots of geophysical problems and structures within the lower 48. So that's an important result. Then I would say the third one is an extension of this tomographic thing using P waves, sort of in the same way that the P wave tomography works almost like an MRI, the same medical imaging type of technology. But some people in curiously the physics department of UC Boulder, which is not really part of the geophysics department, got interested and tried to apply the mathematics of quantum mechanics to the way these waves were propagating back and forth, and they used cross correlations of sort of standing waves or waves that would just arrive. They didn't necessarily have to be from an earthquake, but they could identify through a mathematical correlation that this wave passing this station also arrived at another station a little bit later, and they could use that in a big inversion process to image much more shallowly and in much more comprehensive fashion, even without earthquakes. So this was ambient noise tomography, and it's mathematically possible, but takes pretty good data, pretty clean data sets, and not a lot of gaps to be able to run these algorithms, and the transportable array was clean enough that this method could sort of work. And I think that technique is now applied in many different places, but it's a little hard to explain how it works, but I'm happy the physicists came to our rescue, did something useful.
So we've had a couple of listeners, Daryl and David, have asked how they can be involved in the transportable array. I mean, there's still citizen science to be done, I'm guessing.
There is. So, you know, we got people, students, undergraduate students involved in the siting aspects. Right now in Alaska, that's pretty much limited to professionals. Very serious effort to fly around in a helicopter and put stations in. These guys are trained expedition leaders. You know, that's a difficult thing that you don't get invited on. But I think one of the, you know, other aspects is sort of understanding in your own region where there are earthquakes, why there are earthquakes, and things like that, I think have a lot of interest and can be developed into kind of a curriculum that the public can participate in. But it's a little bit difficult. We don't really, as far as the transportable array goes, have a lot of, I would say, good ways for volunteers, because the scale of the operation requires lots of you know, serious effort day in, day out. It's not a thing that you can come in and right. plant a few trees or something. It doesn't really work that way.
Yeah, I mean, I know there are a few projects. Matt Hall has this Pick This online where he's trying to get crowdsourcing of picking seismic horizons and all kinds of things. It'd be kind of interesting to try to come up with something like that, but just dealing with the massive amount of data and getting the tools installed to get up and running with any kind of seismic data is a real challenge.
That's right. It doesn't really lend itself to casual observers, but I'd like to think about that a little bit more, because I think there probably are some avenues. Mike Williams at University of Massachusetts Amherst had some pretty good exercises where he would assign a student a station, one of the TA stations, and then the whole class would get a different kind of station, and then I think it was about every week, they would look at an event and see, okay, so how come this station is different from that station? And the students would come to learn, oh, well, this one is in a sediment valley, or this one has noise sources, or this one has is just further away. And so they would learn the kind of characteristics of each station as a listening post and what it was like. So that became a way to inform them about this sort of, could be instrument effects, it could be environmental effects, it could be just the nature of the source and propagation became interesting. So I think when you put all those together, it's more of a package than just the raw, you know, trying to show what a P wave looks like and an S wave looks like. There's a lot more, in my view, to the measurement and the instrumentation that you have to sort out and understand.
Right. So we have a couple of last questions from listeners that we want to fit in before we let you go. I know that we don't want to take too much of your time, but listener Thomas had a great question. He said he wanted to know the best animal plus seismometer story from the project.
There have been a couple. Of course, in Alaska, there's always, we take quite a few precautions for bears, because the bears are not always that enthusiastic about having a seismic station on top of their knoll that they happen to like and so on. So, but I would say, you know, there's some funny ones that we had where in Olympic Peninsula and Olympic National Park, we were trying to install seismic stations near in a horse pasture, which was not that unusual, and the horse kept taking the boxes, dragging them across the corral. So you get some unexpected support. But I think one of the ones amongst the team that most people remember is when our guys are working on the stations and one happens not to work, the service team goes out and one of the service engineers is particularly colorful in his reports that he files each time he visits a station. And he reported that, well, you know, this station had dropped offline and he went there and he came to find that, it was a trailer house and didn't seem like anybody had been around there for a long time and the power had gotten turned off, so our satellite dish was no longer working. You know, the only sort of sign that anybody had even been there, there was a cat in the window. And so he went there and couldn't find anybody around and had to basically set up some solar panels because the power wasn't going to be on and so on, and came back the next day and this and that. Never found anybody there and said, well, now I got the station running in autonomous mode. We don't need the power. And everyone on the team said, what about the cat? What happened to the cat? And the cat was okay.
Till the bear got him.
Yeah.
Well, and I guess along that line then, listener Martin asked what the single biggest technical obstacle was during the project. And we've covered bits and pieces of this before, but if you had to put your finger on one thing that was the most difficult to sort out or the most recurring problem, what was that?
Probably the most, so early on it was data communications and how you could set up reliable real-time data links. And that has remained a complicated challenge in Alaska where there is no infrastructure. That we solved in Alaska by spending lots and lots of money. So we found a satellite-based data transmitting solution that involves a very simple little antenna that you can aim at the sky and it can deliver 350 kilobit data for, but it costs $1,000 a month. And so it's per station. So that's an expensive one, but I think the biggest technical challenge is the power for a remote autonomous station in Alaska. It requires a complex combination of solar panels with a big bank of batteries that charges up during the summer and then is on its own basically through the winter and has to be able to survive complete submersion in snow where the solar panels don't see the sun for months at a time. And in this case, we had to develop a fairly complicated hybrid stack of batteries, lithium ion batteries, as well as AGM batteries and a complex charging circuit and power management thing that's monitored by text messages coming via Iridium satellites. So that was a complicated thing to put together. And we are pretty satisfied with the way it worked last winter. I think we can do better. There was a few minor faults in the power system, but we went down a few other alleys in trying to solve that problem with possible fuel cell generators and other elaborate systems, but batteries turned out to be the way to go, and we put a ton of batteries at each station, literally.
That's what I've learned from geophysics, is that it's all batteries.
Yeah. If anybody asks you to help on a seismic experiment, tell them you can't lift more than 50 pounds.
Exactly.
Well, so I guess the last question then that I had for you is, where do you see seismology, or maybe more specifically seismic instrumentation, in the next 10 to 20 years?
Well, I would like to see the seismic instrumentation become much more uniform, much more modern. There's a lot of old equipment that's out there. And I think this can become possible so that the technical aspects of the equipment produce better data, and we'll be able to solve some of the lingering problems which are hampered by resolution, timing, and instrument fidelity. So I think the instruments are getting a lot better. There's a convergence of some of the technologies in both the sensing as well as the data loggers and the data communications are developing, but they have not been knitted into a really cohesive, well-integrated package. And I think that's the challenge, is to do that on a large scale. So to give you an example, strong motion recording in urban settings could be quite easily facilitated if we were to put an instrument at every Starbucks. It's the sort of exact match of distribution. The stores are in urban areas in a tight cluster, and not so much everywhere else. They have power, they have internet, you know, it would be a perfect thing. But it would require something like, in the same way the TA is, it has to operate at a big scale where you can do things and engineer a very optimized solution for that particular thing. And it can't be sort of one-off 20 or 30 instruments that are more general and therefore not really customized for the particular thing. So we need to get the scale of our science matched up with the instrumentation.
Great. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us and answer all these questions. It really is an absolutely amazing project, and I'm looking forward to seeing all the results that are going to keep coming out for many years.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad you're interested.
All right. Well, I thought that was a really fun interview, and I learned quite a bit, and I just couldn't imagine trying to run this entire project.
I just have to say, I hope that kitty cat's still okay.
Yes. And we'll link in a lot of the videos and so on that he mentioned into the show notes, as well as I'll link in some of the neat animations, the ground motion animations.
Yep, excellent.
From the array as well. Yeah. So, Shannon, I think that means it's time for everybody's favorite segment of the show, Fun Paper Friday.
Yay!
Yay!
I can't reach my cowbell.
And for this week, you picked out a paper that has been in the news some.
Right, exactly. So I thought that's maybe why we do it. And we're just going to quickly go over it, since the transportable ray was so interesting and we had so many listener questions to get to. So this was in Nature, and this is just a Nature news blurb about geologists spy an eighth continent, Zealandia. And so I don't know if you've heard about this. It was on, I think it was on NPR the other day, and everybody's been talking about this new continent.
Yeah, so I actually hadn't heard about this. I've been kind of down in a hidey hole all week.
It's because the internet was broken. That's why you couldn't hear about it.
Right. So this is based on a GSA paper that just came out, called Zealandia, Earth's Hidden Continent. And it's by Mortimer et al., from GNS. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the idea is that there is an eighth distinct continent.
Right. And if you haven't figured it out already, it's where New Zealand is.
Right.
So this new continent, I mean, what's interesting is that when you read this, we talk about the use of the word continent and how it doesn't actually have quite the same significance in terms of geographers versus geologists. Europe and Asia being the main thing, right? Because that's one continent to us.
Right.
But not to geographers.
Well, and even among the fields, they say there's not really an accepted definition.
Which is so weird, because it's like the first thing you talk about, you know, plate tectonics and continental crust. And what? We don't have a definition for this?
Yeah, it seems like there should be a I'm sure there are some definitions around, but it's one of those things that's debated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that was interesting in and of itself.
Yeah, that was interesting, like you said. But first of all, Zealandia, great name. but second of all, how do you find the lost continent of Zealandia? Well, you do things like look at satellite gravity and bathymetry data.
I didn't want to bring the geoid into this, but...
Yeah, it's a bumpy thing, Shannon.
I know. I don't like to talk about it, obviously, but it really helped. So the big deal is continental crust and oceanic crust, big density differences, right?
Very big density. We're talking about crusts that are very rich in silica versus very basaltic crust.
Right, exactly. And so by using some of these remote sensing techniques, they've basically been able to outline this Zealandia. And this actually isn't a new idea. This has been around for quite some time.
Right, but this paper kind of had a really nice compilation of some of the quantitative bits surrounding this. So looking at the bathymetry around the area, you can even see that this area is slightly raised from the seabed, as well as having a lower density indicated by the satellite gravity, indicating that it is a more siliclastic crust.
Right. And so it's actually quite large if you look at this compared to Australia. And so where did this guy come from? When did it break off? You know, why is it its own continent? And so this guy came from Gondwana, and it rifted away from that continent about 100 million years ago. And so it's just this little, well, I say little bitty, but, you know, size of Australia. Continent that got ripped off of Gondwana, and it says today only 6% of it remains above the water. So basically New Zealand and New Caledonia is what you can see of Zealandia.
Right. And I mean, I guess before we really thought of this as kind of a collection of continental fragments and islands and not such a cohesive thing, but the data here points to this being a distinct block.
Right. Exactly. And I mean, if you're having trouble imagining this, imagine just draining the earth of all its water, which is what they talk about, and you would definitely see this big raised area that is coherent. And that's this eighth continent, I guess.
Right. And remember, as you're draining the ocean, it's going to go the other way if you're in the Northern Hemisphere.
God. I couldn't resist, could you?
No. No, you have to get that right in your simulation.
Exactly.
And, you know, so the idea here, though, is that if we're going to call this a distinct continent, we all have to agree on it. And they say it's probably going to be an uphill battle.
Right, because it's just going to be people adopting it as we move forward and saying eight continents and using this as Zealandia, which I can't get over. It sounds like a science fiction book. But
right.
But I mean, besides that, so what's the deal, you know?
Yeah, so they actually interviewed somebody from Monash University in Melbourne, and they said that claiming that Zealandia is a continent is a bit like stamp collecting. So what?
I mean,
which is, I mean, that's a pretty harsh critique, even for a scientific review.
Yes, it is. I mean, I get it. I guess the fact that, like, it's always sort of been there and it's kind of under the water and it doesn't really change how we're viewing that landmass, maybe that's the so what. But it's also kind of cool because it is pretty large. It's a pretty large area.
Yeah, and that shows you that in 2017, we still might not have some of the fundamental concepts about our planet nailed down.
That's so disturbing. But that's also the exciting reason why you should study geology.
Exactly.
Yep.
Something new every day.
Exactly. So.
Yes. Well, there you go. That was your Fun Paper Friday abbreviated version. If you have a fun paper that you would like us to talk about, or anything else that you'd like to write in terms of feedback, we really enjoy reading it. You can also send us audio comments, and we would absolutely love it if you went to the iTunes store and wrote a review. It looks like several of you have, and we had some really nice reviews in there. We appreciate it because that helps other folks find the show. So, Shannon, how can they get a hold of us?
Send us your audio comments or your regular typed out comments. Show at don'tpanicgeocast.com. As always, we're on Twitter at don'tpanicgeo. John is at geo_Lehman. I'm at Shannon Doolin. And we're usually hanging out in the Slack chat room, swung.rocks on the Don't Panic channel.
And until next week, remember, don't panic.
It's not an exact science.
Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed are solely ours and do not necessarily reflect the views of our